Andrew Roberts' new book, Napoleon, is the first one-volume biography to take advantage of the recent publication of Napoleon's 33,000 surviving letters, which radically transform our understanding of his character and motivation. We see him as he was, visionary military leader, decisive multitasker, and a micromanaging workaholic who was surprisingly willing to forgive those who betrayed him. Roberts traveled to 53 of Napoleon's 60 battle sites, discovered crucial new documents in archives, and even made the long trip by boat to St. Helena. The name of the book is Napoleon, A Life. It is published by Viking, and we welcome Andrew Roberts to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Looking forward to it, Jay. Thank you.
What brought you to the life of Napoleon?
Oh, a fascination pretty much all my life. My late mother gave me a biography of Napoleon when I was 10 years old, which I devoured, and I've been pretty much fascinated with him ever since.
I mentioned the letters. At what point did you become aware of these letters and start to think that this could be a major project that you could undertake?
Oh, I've been aware of them since they started to be published in 2004, and the project undertaken by the Fondation Napoleon in Paris, a great scholarly organization there, has been bringing them out, volumes out, pretty much every year since then. And there are now 12 volumes, and it's the most impressive scholarly collection, beautifully footnoted, all in chronological order, of course. And so I was very fortunate, really, that my book should be the first cradle-to-the-grave single-volume life in English to be published since then.
Give us a sense of what you learn from the letters.
Well, I think overwhelmingly the most powerful sense is the extraordinary compartmentalization of his mind that Napoleon was able to achieve. He was able, in the same day that he was sending his army across Europe for the Austerlitz campaign, also to write to Pierre Forfait, the consul of Genoa, to order him to stop taking his mistress to the opera. When he was in just about to fight the Battle of Borodino, a terrible battle, a massive battle where more people died on that day than in any other day in human history until the First World War, he was also able to sit down and write the regulations of the Comédie Française. And then a few weeks later, in the Kremlin, when the Russians had burned down two-thirds of their own co-capital, he could write the rules of a girls' school that he wanted to set up in Saint-Denis. So this astonishing compartmentalization of his mind was the thing that really struck me the most.
It seems in the book that you believe that he is a man who is misunderstood. Is that fair to say?
I think so, yes. I think the overwhelming, certainly by British historians, who tend always to see Napoleon through the prism of the Second World War and assume that because he was a dictator, he was also a kind of proto-Hitler figure, I think completely misunderstands the creative side, the builder in Napoleon, the positive aspects of him, yes. Although in this book is no hagiography, it's an objective life. I point out how ruthless he is and the war crimes that he committed as well.
You compare him in many ways to Washington, George Washington, and yet there were very stark contrasts as well.
Very much. Well, of course, Washington wasn't a dictator. And when Washington came to the end of his term in office, he stepped down, the modern Cincinnatus, as he was rightly called. But they did face very different kind of threats. America wasn't under a military threat from Yorktown through to the War of 1812, which is a good 30 years. In that precise period, for the 30 years after the French Revolution, there were no fewer than seven European coalitions that were set up to try to invade and smash France. So Napoleon wasn't having to deal with the same issues, of course, but they were much more aggressive.
But both considered great generals.
I think so, yes, of course. And I mean, Napoleon fought 60 battles, of which he only lost seven. I think under any criteria, that would be considered a pretty good rate. He was, to all intents and purposes, yes, a military genius.
I mentioned you walking the battlefields in research for this volume. Walking the battlefields in France and Italy and Austria and Poland, Russia, Belarus, how does that influence your view of Napoleon's military leadership?
Well, that's why I think I can use the word genius. It's an overused word, of course, needless to say, especially in history. But I think when talking about Napoleon's military attributes, it's a fair one. I'm a great believer in going to battlefields. I think that it's a bit like a detective visiting the scene of the crime. You know, you have to do it in order to get a sense of what went on. You can very often see the spark of genius that he showed when you look at the topography of a battlefield and see the cliffs or the town or the river or whatever. There's one in Israel that Battle of Mount Tabor, which isn't actually anywhere near Mount Tabor, but it's called the Battle of Mount Tabor, and the way in which Napoleon was able to hide his army in the undulations around the Vale of Jezil as he got behind the Turkish force was only really made itself sort of easy to understand when I went there. It's very difficult to understand on maps.
In your research and looking at this, as you say, a cradle-to-grave biography and looking at his entire life, what do you take out of that you want people to understand in reading all of these pages and understanding? What do you want us to understand about him in the end?
I'd like people to understand that what he did really was to take the best Enlightenment concepts from the French Revolution, ideas about religious toleration and equality before the law and the abolition of feudalism and meritocracy, these really important concepts which absolutely underpin modern civilized democracies today. And he was the person who codified them, who extended them geographically, who protected them from the onslaught of the Ancien Régime, both the French one, of course, but also of the Prussians and Russians and Austrians, who wanted to destroy these concepts. And so he does come over very much for me as somebody who kept the best bits of the French Revolution and discarded all the terrible bits to do with the guillotine and the terror and the de-Christianization and all the various other appalling acts of revolutionary violence.
You spoke a moment ago about British historians and how he is seen in Britain. How do you think he is seen in this country, especially as you go into great detail of Napoleon selling Louisiana to Thomas Jefferson? What do you think our takeaway in this country should be?
Oh, well, I mean, he never tried to invade you, so you're going to have a slightly better
different perspective
opinion of him in the first place. Yeah. Precisely, yeah. Better than that, of course, he was, as you say, the other side of what is effectively the greatest land deal in the history of the world. You bought land which covers 13 states of the modern USA, going all the way from Louisiana up to the Canadian frontier for 2 cents an acre. I mean, it's the best deal of all time. Mm. And it was a great deal for him as well, because first of all, he needed the 80 million francs that he got from it. And secondly, he never wanted France to go to war with America. And he could see that the westward push of the United States of America in the early 19th century was going to be unstoppable. And so it actually was one of those rare deals in history which genuinely benefited both sides.
What did Jefferson make of them?
Jefferson didn't much like Napoleon personally. He thought that he was a ruthless dictator, but he wasn't going to allow that to get in the way of... They never met, by the way. Jefferson his time in Paris was far earlier, of course, than Napoleon's time. But nonetheless, he was able to get over any personal feelings he had over it in order to do this quite amazing land deal.
Talk a little bit about the death of Napoleon. You write about it in the book. Such controversy surrounding his death. What do you make of that?
I'm surprised by it. I'm rather shocked that it should still be, these conspiracy theories should still be swirling around, especially on the internet. The fact is that the day after his death, his body was taken next door from the room in which he died to the next door room and laid out on a trestle table, and seven distinguished doctors opened him up and found that there was no part of his stomach, virtually no part of his stomach, that was not cancerous. And his father had died of cancer at the age of 35, his sister had died of cancer, his illegitimate son was going to die of cancer. It's what killed the Bonapartes. And the idea that he died of arsenic poisoning, simply because some strands of his hair have been tested and are high in arsenic, tells us nothing, because in the 19th century, arsenic was used for all sorts of things that it isn't today. And loads of other people in the 18th century, when you test their hair, they also have high arsenic content.
What do you think of his place in history? As you say, he's misunderstood in your opinion. So how do you think that legacy will change these centuries later?
Well, it does change from country to country. In France, he's very controversial. On the right, the Gaullists admire him. On the left, the socialists certainly don't. I think that people see history through the lens of their own experiences and their own times. So I'm hoping that we will, as time goes on, we will get more objective about the man who did, after all, create the Code Napoleon. He created the educational system with the lycée and the Grande École and Sorbonne and so on, and who was able to create the Banque de France and the Légion d'Honneur and all of these great aspects of France, the beautiful architecture in Paris, of course, being another example. And we ought to be able to see him through not through the lens of 200-year-old British military propaganda.
The name of the book is Napoleon, A Life. It is published by Viking. Andrew Roberts, a pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us. I thank you very much.
Very kind, Jay. Thanks very much. It was enjoyable.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Napoleon, A Life. It is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.